Welcome to a radical discussion of independence, free will, liberty, and the left-hand path. This is Damon Ossoff with your host, Paul Frederick.
Another episode of Damonosophy, where we continue to fight for liberty in the left-hand path. My guest this evening, Mr. Boyd Rice, musician, artist, actor, photographer, author, and he's got a new book out, The Last Testament of Anton LaVey. Boyd, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Yeah, and I have to give props to our mutual friend, Aaron Powell of the band Awen, who I think was instrumental in getting this conversation to happen. And I think you were recently on tour with him in Europe, huh?
Well, yeah, a couple years back I was on tour with him in Europe, and we really only did several shows, but we went all over the place, and we had many long nights up, late-night conversations at hotels over drinks, and that was great, you know, that was worth the price of admission.
No, that's awesome. Aaron's a great guy. So I did shows with him with my band Asmodeus Sex, like, many years ago, because he lives in Dallas, I live in Houston, and so we did a couple of shows together back in the day, and I just recently kind of like reconnected with him, and you know, he's a really great guy. And then you and I met. I don't think that you would necessarily remember this because it's a while back, but 1997, you and I met at the Dome Room in Chicago when you were on tour with Death in June and Strength Through Joy.
Yeah, I loved that. Was a great venue. I think it was later like taken over by some rapper who turned it into a hip-hop club or something, but that was a great venue, yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't know about that. Now I remember, so the Dome Room had this big picture up at the top of it. It's like a Zeus god-like face, like way up at the top. It had all these tiers, and it's like a really cool place. And I was there with other mutual friends of ours, Thomas Thorne.
I haven't, Thomas used to come through town about once a year, but I haven't heard from him for ages and ages.
So he's doing good. He moved to Florida, and he, like, about 2 years ago, they did a Electric Hellfire Club reunion show in Miami, and he invited me to come down, and we opened for him, and it was so awesome. It's like, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, whatever it was, and it's like, you know, Rich Frost was there, and Richter and all these old guys. And it was, So, you know, I thinking of this 1997 show, you were doing this. I kind of consider this the height of this, the Total War thing. That's the song that I remember. And when you were doing that song at that time, it was just amazingly incredible and powerful. I wanted to ask.
Well, thank you.
Did you suspect at that time that a few years later that America would actually be plunged into not necessarily a total war, but a state of kind of perpetual war?
No. But it's funny because when at the point when the U.S. Began bombing Iraq, Mute Records, they play this music in their stairwells and when you're waiting on the phone. And Daniel Miller, when the first bombs dropped, he said, "Start playing Total War on repeat, and we'll play it constantly as long as the war goes on." So I would call up and I'd hear this weird stuff. I'd say, "What the hell are you guys playing? It's some weird noisy thing." They said, "Boyd, we're playing you. That's Total War." Yeah, these, you know, Yeah, the new wars aren't as interesting as the old wars. And, you know, Total War was meant to be a kind of a personal thing, you know, an inner thing. It's not actually, you know, going out and shooting at people or having bayonets or... although I've got guns and bayonets, but...
But no, it's more about like an internal, struggle.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and so I got asked about this. I saw you met Diamond and Silk recently.
Oh yes, yes.
How was that?
That was amazing. It was like a uniquely American phenomena because they're just these two gals who. Put these rants of theirs on the internet, and then it just blew up and they became famous because of that. And they're just like two ordinary gals who have larger-than-life personalities and strong opinions, and they have transitioned from just being two average gals to these women who go on the road, and they have like a really polished showbiz act, but it's still them just like telling their opinions and stuff, and people just love them, you know. I went down, they were in Colorado Springs, and I went down with Whale Song Partridge, and we spent the night in the hotel where they were appearing, but that was a lot of fun.
No, it looks like it. That sounds awesome. I've seen them online, and you know, everything you're saying about them is absolutely correct. They're just so intense and entertaining, and what I really like about them is it's not, you know, not so much the you know, the point where they're going with it necessarily, but the fact that they're smashing expectations, they're like not supposed to be supporting the things that they're talking about supporting right now. And it just makes people so angry. And I just love it. And this really, to me, that's kind of LaVeyan, right? Smashing expectations, you know, law of the forbidden.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing with the whole LaVey aspect of that is like the villain or the anti-hero does piss off a lot of people, but then the people who they don't piss off are the people who love them as much as the other people hate them. So it's like the room I was in was a room full of love where people were just saying, oh my God, I can't believe I'm seeing these wild women, sassy women saying all this stuff, you know, and they're hilarious.
yeah, no, they're totally on cue. So this is a question that was asked to me recently, and I got to ask this to you because you knew Anton LaVey personally, and we're going to talk about your book, you know, which I think is just fabulous and has some great insights in it. But what do you think Anton LaVey, if he were alive today, what would he think about Donald Trump?
I just think he would love the whole atmosphere that's going on, and that he would love the divisiveness and love the way people are losing their mind. And he'd, you know, he was a very apolitical person because to him, politics really didn't matter because he'd always, you know, in the 50s, he was living the same life as the life he was living during the period when I knew him, which was the last 10 years of his life. So he wasn't one of these people who's dependent upon whatever happening in politics and thinking, oh, well, when the new person gets into office, then my life can change, then I can be happy. And, you know, he wasn't a person who lived that way. So on one level, it would be irrelevant to him, but I think he would like Trump because he's a shit stirrer, and he's a tough guy, and he's, you know, he's ever since I was in high school, people always scolded me for being apolitical. And I said, you know, politicians are just, they're these people who are, they're liars. They tell you whatever they think you want to hear. And when they get into office, they don't keep any of their promises. And, you know, it's like, I'm not waiting for, you know, I can change my life right now if I want to. I'm not waiting for the political situation to change. So I would always say, I'll be interested in politics when a businessman runs for office. So, you know, so I always thought, well, if a businessman or an engineer, somebody was in charge of the government, they'd understand the way things really work in the real world. They wouldn't think, you know, oh, if we throw a bunch of money at a problem, you know, if we send billions of dollars over to Iran, they're going to love us all of a sudden. you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're
mm-hmm.
idiotic. So, you know. So I think I think he would just appreciate the whole phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. That's what I tend to think too. Is that he would just be chuckling about
exactly.
No.
Yes.
I mean, when that last election happened, I was out at a bar, drinking and watching everything happen on the TV and thinking, well, you know, Hillary's going to win, right? There's just nothing, you know, no other possibility here. And then when I woke up in the morning, I got a text telling me that Trump won. And now, and again, I didn't have a dog in this race. You know, I didn't have a horse in this race. But when uh-huh. I saw that, I just laughed. I just laughed so hard. Because it was so unexpected. It's so bizarre. And he's so contrarian. And he's so, you know, but at the same time, you know, I feel, you know, to invest your life and your personality and your destiny in another person, right, a demagogue of any kind, is kind of collectivist and not very satanic or individualist, but still, it's goddamn entertaining. You
know? Yeah, that's what I've got to say. This has been the most entertaining 3 years that I can remember.
So let's talk about Anton LaVey. Let's talk about your book. Tell me why you wrote this book and the whole vibe and your vision and what you're trying to do with it.
I'd always, you know, had in the back of my mind that at some point I'm going to have to write something about LaVey and all these stories I have about him and so on. But a couple of years ago, this organization in Hollywood called Lethal Amounts put on this Anton LaVey show on Hollywood Boulevard. And they had all these photos of LaVey memorabilia, and it was like the 20th anniversary of his death. And the people who attended, like if they paid an extra $100 a piece, they could go up in this little theater and hear me speak and Carl LaVey and Kenneth Anger. So all these people paid this money to see all of us. And and I just thought, oh, well, you know, the time is obviously right because there's a new LaVey book. There's a number of documentaries coming out. It was a ridiculous documentary about him and Jane Mansfield, which I couldn't even finish watching, you know. It was just horrible. But it indicates that there's an interest there. And I me and Carla shared the stage, and we just sort of, like, shared our memories about her father. And I thought, wow, this is some really great stuff. You know, it's like people don't really, you know, I grew up right when that whole thing was happening. So I remember Anton LaVey as a pop culture icon, and I remember seeing him on the newsstand and seeing the Satanic Bible in the checkout line at the supermarket being offered for sale. I mean, it was a huge phenomenon, and I just thought, you know, it's like people who didn't live through that really have no idea of imagining how huge it was or what it was like. So I tried to, like, capture something of that, like what that period of time was like and what he was like as a person, because he's far more complex than a lot of things would lead you to believe. You know, he's a very interesting guy.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head with the complexity. I mean, he's definitely complex. And there's one point in the book where you talk about he kind of would pivot between, like, several different personalities. Like, you had the German, you know, the German expressionist personality. Then he had the old Jewish cynic personality. And then he had a Fu Manchu personality. And it's like, no, that just really lays it out. That makes so much sense when you consider that he kind of fluctuated between these different things. And you can see this in his works, too, that the different works that he put out, even different, you know, the ceremonies, like in the Satanic rituals, each of them kind of partakes of one of these, like, one of these vibes or one of his, one of his personalities.
Yeah, it's just like, every aspect of everything he was into is like part of this vast cosmology, and it's really hard to be able to get your head around the whole thing unless you sort of spent a lot of time with him, and you know, it's like every week he would, at a certain point, you know, I'd go over at 7 in the evening and I'd leave like at 6 in the morning. So I'd stay there until the sun came up, and every week he would show me one of his favorite movies. And so I got to see a lot of movies I never would have seen under any other circumstances.
And
film noir thing.
And what time period was this when you were meeting with him?
It was in, it started in the late 80s, like 1986 or early 87. And and I went over every week, sometimes twice a week, until I left San Francisco in October of 89. But after that, I went back all the time, you know, up until the time when he died. And I saw him really just a couple weeks before he died. I went up, I took the Amtrak out there and did an interview with him for Seconds Magazine. And that, as it turns out, is his last interview. So that's what The Last Testament of Anton Zandor LaVey, one of the things in it is his final interview. And Blanche Barton and her updated biography of him said that that's one of the best interviews he ever did. It was probably because I was so familiar with him, knew what he was interested in, and knew what to ask. So, I'm glad that got back in print again.
And that is,
that's
like one of the most touching parts, I think, of the book that I've looked at is when you talk about how you got the phone call.
Oh God, yeah.
And you know what I think? I mean, I remember where I was the day. I mean, maybe that says something about, you know, people of, you know, who are into Satanism at the time when he died. It's kind of like our Kennedy moment or the 9/11 moment, that you're always going to remember where you are and what was going on when you heard that Anton LaVey died. Because it's one of those things, I think no one expected, you know, that to happen. No one thought that was really going to happen. But can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Well, me and Death and June had done a show someplace in New York City, and there was a goth club called The Bank, and it was in a place that had originally been a bank. So they were throwing after our show, they were... What's that?
I was just going to say, I played at that club. I know exactly what you're
talking about. Wow. Yeah, so they were throwing a private party for us and some other people at the bank. And I was talking with all these young people who were interested in Anton LaVey, and they were all saying, you know, what's Anton LaVey like? And blah, 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 and, you know. And,
yeah.
And some of them actually said something about when he died. And I said, no, LaVey said... you know, he's not going to die because it would give too many assholes, you know, pleasure. So he's just going to have to tough it out and live forever. And then I get this call and I go way down in this bank vault and, you know, hear that Anton LaVey had died. And, you know, he seemed perfectly healthy when I'd seen him a short while earlier.
Wow. That's really weird because now I'm putting together the timing of all that. So what, that was like, was it 97 or 98?
Yeah, 97, I think.
So, because I'm putting it all together that I came through there with Morphine Angel was the band that I was in at the time. That's the band that, you know, we did shows with the Electric Hellfire Club and stuff like that. And that's when we came through there, and it must have been shortly after you were there and heard all that. So it's really interesting putting together all the timing on this. And another interesting thing is you mentioned how, you know, you wanted to fill in the gaps for sort of how big all this stuff was in that, you know, in kind of that mid-60s era when it was really going on and it was really hot, you know? Because
yeah.
That's something for me. Like I'm, you know, I'm 51 years old. I was born in 1968. So by the time I found the Satanic Bible when I was 13 years old, you know, this shit was all over, as far as I can tell. And plus, I lived in Nebraska, right? So
okay,
there's not anyone else around, you know, who's into this stuff. So you know, I discovered this book and this philosophy, and it was incredibly empowering. Completely changed my outlook on life. You know, I was depressive, feeling sorry for myself, kid, you know, at the time. And that book was like really empowering, and it turned things around. You know, it inspired me to turn things around for myself. But I always had this question, is this stuff actually still going on? You know, is this stuff real? Are there actually people out here doing that? And I never knew that. I never knew that, you know, for many years later, like until, you know, 1988 or so, when I started to make connections. But that whole time, and I think there's a lot of people like that. You don't know about that time period. You don't know how big this was. You don't know how embedded in that local, in that regional, you know, West Coast culture, Satanism was becoming, you know?
And LaVey was extremely well-known figure in San Francisco just because he was an eccentric and, you know, he made good copies for the newspaper. He was like an organist and a stage hypnotist, and he, you know, went to art fairs to try to sell his paintings and things. And so it's before he did the Church of Satan. He was a very well-known figure, and then he started doing his lectures, series of occult lectures, a thing called the Magic Circle. And, you know, he'd have ads for that in the newspaper every week in San Francisco, and people would show up and pay to hear these lectures. And then some cop who he worked with on the police force really liked him and would always attend these lectures. And at one point he said, you know, Anton, you've got enough material here to start your own religion. You could start your own church. And so he thought, well, yeah, that's true. So, yeah. So it evolved from that into the Order of the Trapezoid, and then that was just like a more serious, formalized sort of occult fraternity. But eventually, you know, he changed it into the Church of Satan and realized that he could take these ideas that could remain in this closed circle of like an underground of occultists, or he could take these same ideas and project them outwards into pop culture so that everybody would be influenced by him. Everybody in the United States would know who he was. His face would be synonymous with those ideas. And, you know, it worked beyond his wildest dreams. Because it's when, in the 50s, he was down in L.A., you know, working in these strip clubs, playing an organ. He was virtually unknown. And he came back to Hollywood 10 years later, and he was as famous as any of the movie stars he was hanging out with. He was, like, just as famous as Jane Mansfield or Sammy Davis Jr. or, I'm forgetting the guy's name. Anyway, you know, he met a lot of people when he lived out there. He lived in Jane's pink palace for a long time after she died. Yeah. I think he saw that the group dynamic wasn't really working out and that he would just put this information out there and that he would essentially be a recluse, and he would still like fly all over the world. Like there were like Mexican movie stars who were into Satan, and they had giant statues of Satan in their house, and he would go visit them, or he'd go visit people in Europe, and you know. But he's, you know, got to a point when I met him. He said, "I can count on the fingers of my two hands how many people walk through that door there, and I'd still have a lot of fingers left over." So. So you can see if you look at that way, a movie like Satanus, and you see LaVey is in this room full of people, and they're all interesting people, and they're all from every walk of life, and they're obviously unique people, and but he's up there talking, and then all these other people are talking, and he's just sort of sitting there smiling to himself and waiting for them to shut up so he could continue talking. And that's not a good dynamic for him. It's not a good dynamic for the people who want to hear what he's into, because, you know, it's like our evenings, I would just, you know, I would shut up and listen. until, you know, I was just like, I don't want to, like, interject my opinion here when I can sit here and be regaled with these amazing tales from, you know.
Right. No, and I know exactly what part of Satanus you're talking about. All these people are carrying on, and Anton can't get a word in edgewise. And when you watch the movie, you're like, I wish these people would shut up because I want to know what he says, you know? I don't care about, you know, Isaac Bonowitz, like, getting his penis blessed, you know? That's like one of the famous moments from that film.
I was just going to say, you can also see, it's like it really did start off with, even though the group dynamic wasn't appropriate, it started off with a good group dynamic because these were people who are intellectuals back when that word meant something that wasn't derogatory. I mean, they were people who were self-taught and intellectually curious, and they were individuals living their own kind of Epicurean life, and they came together around this man and these ideas. And, you know, it's like by the time you're talking about, it's like the people who bought the Satanic Bible were like teenagers listening to heavy metal music or something. So it was a whole different demographic. So that really wouldn't have been worth LaVey's time.
So, and didn't you say that he said at one point that everything was like over in 1969?
No, he said the world turned to shit in 1969.
Oh, the world turned to shit in 1969. So was there anything, did he have anything particular in mind? Like, what the...
I mean,
Manson murder.
He didn't have to think about it. I said, so when exactly did everything turn to shit? When did the cultural inversion start? And he said, he didn't hesitate a bit. He said, 1969. That's when feminism raised its ugly head. Women stopped wearing garters and stockings, and everybody was wearing pantyhose. It all went to, you know, went rotten in 1969.
So, that's interesting, and you know, I think one of the things that LaVey was rebelling against, of course, he's rebelling against, you know, the obvious things like Christianity and mediocrity, but he was also rebelling against the white light, so-called white light, you know, paganism and witchcraft, which he criticizes these things in the Satanic Bible. And at that time, you know, feminism and all of that stuff is wrapped up in feminism and a left-wing political movement. And, I mean, this is to me, seems very clearly something that he was also rebelling against. Do you think that that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. And the fuzzy thinking of the hippie generation. He just saw that as being, like I did. I mean, I was 13 at the time, but even I could see that this is something that's weak and confused, and you got all these people who are like in their late teens and early 20s. Your brain doesn't stop developing until age 25. So you get all these young people with undeveloped brains, and they're all ingesting mind-altering drugs. So, of course, they can all sit around and listen to whatever album they're listening to and agree that everybody should love one another and there should be peace and universal brotherhood and all that crap. So, you know, LaVey hated that. He hated that fuzzy thinking. And it's the ironic thing is, like, that fuzzy thinking of the 60s, of the hippie era, it's like the exact bedrock of modern liberalism is based on all that fuzzy thinking, these nice-sounding ideas that are just highly delusional and unrealistic, you know. But now people are being forced to you know, alter their existence to try to echo that, and it's not working out well.
No, so there's a modern satanic movement. I don't know if you've seen the T-shirts that say Satanic Feminism. There's a current movement that calls itself satanic that really embraces all of those left-wing, you know, hippie ideas. And they're kind of trying to whitewash LaVey out of it. You know, LaVey had really strong ideas about women and the virtue of women and the power of women, and he believed there's two sexes. And, you know, this is all apparent throughout, you know, the Complete Witch. But now this modern movement is in this weird position of trying to carry forward this torch of what LaVey started, but also at the same time, it's like they're trying to surgically remove this one piece out of it. And I'm not sure where it's going to go. What do you think about that?
I don't think it'll go anywhere. You know, it's I've heard tell of these people get together and pick up trash in certain neighborhoods, and they attend women's rights rallies and show a satanic presence. You know, if you want to be a liberal, just be a liberal. There's plenty of organizations for liberals out there. Don't try to co-opt something that's absolutely the antithesis of liberalism, and then, you know, make it into something nice.
No, they're really like,
because, you know, and I'm doing some snuff. I think, where was I going with that? I forget what you just said. I did some snuff and I lost my train of thought. Yeah, well, you know, that was his, one of his pet peeves was the people who called themselves Satanists, and but would always add, oh, but we're nice guys. And I remember he said to me once, he said, because the people at Research got pissed off at Anton LaVey and at me, and they said, Anton LaVey used to be a really nice guy until he started hanging out with you. And I told LaVey that, and he laughed, and he said, I've never been a really nice guy. He said, damn it, Boyd, I'm a miserable son of a bitch. I don't want people going around saying I'm a nice guy. Yeah, I can understand during the satanic panic where people's trying to say, oh, no, we aren't these horrible people. But I think, you know, the satanic panic went away, and they're still doing that. They're still trying to convince everybody they're nice guys. And, you know, that's not why I was attracted to Anton LaVey or the Church of Satan. I was attracted because it was mysterious, and it was all about the forbidden and the shadow side, and it seemed dangerous, you know. Mm-hmm. And if I was 13 nowadays and exposed to any of these people, modern people who call themselves Satanists, claim to be Satanists, I just, you know, I don't know what the appeal would be. I don't know who they're appealing to.
And I wanted to mention, when you talk about the Satanic Bible being available in supermarkets at the time, which is so inconceivable to me. However, I do have a friend in Houston who was around in the 60s and was hip to all this stuff back then, and he had told me that that's where he got the Satanic Bible originally, was at a supermarket in Houston, Texas. So it was available in supermarkets well outside of California. If it's in Texas, then, you know, that's some cultural penetration is what that means.
I got my copy of a Food Basket supermarket in Lemon Grove, California. Mm-hmm. And I remember I also saw in there The Devil's Avenger. And we didn't get it like the very time I saw it. And I never saw it again, you know, until, like, I found a copy 20 years later or something. But, yeah, that stuff was everywhere. I mean, people, I go into it in the book, and I've talked about it elsewhere, about how there was a weekly magazine called Man, Myth, and Magic. And it was sort of an encyclopedia of the occult. And there was a billboard for Man, Myth, and Magic with an Austin Spare drawing of, like, sort of this Baphomet goat man guy on the cover. And there was a billboard for that in Lemon Grove. There were commercials for it on TV. And the commercial said, finally, at last, there's a magazine devoted to witchcraft, demonology, the tarot, voodoo, black magic. And I just thought, wow, this is going to be great. So there was this big occult revival. And partially because I think LaVey was spearheading that. So all this occult stuff was going out because people were thinking about it. I just saw, what was the episode? I was just watching an episode of some television show last night, or a couple nights ago, where we were talking, a magazine publisher was talking about, you're going to do an article about the Satanic Occult Club in San Francisco? I don't know if that's a good idea. And it was like this show from 1970 or something. They're obviously referring to the Church of Satan.
Wow. So there's an interview that you do in here where you ask him, some members of your organization say they believe in Satan as an anthropomorphic deity. Anton says the people who believe in an anthropomorphic Satan are possibly the ideal or born Satanists, so on and so forth. Where do you think he really stood on that question?
Well, I think, we discussed at length manipulating archetypes is a basic part of lesser magic. And, he says everybody has an archetype, and if you understand what it is and if you manipulate it, you can use it to your advantage. For instance, he said there are some people who are Satanists, and they don't look terribly satanic, or they don't look sinister. They maybe look like a librarian or something. He said, well, a person like that could take advantage of that archetype and, wear a tweedy suit with leather patches on the elbows and try to look professorial, and people would accord them that respect that you would give a professor. So they could make, even if they look ineffectual, they could make it work for them. So I think, he really saw Satan as one of the most powerful archetypes of, the last few millennia of Western civilization. And he realized at a certain point that he just incarnated that. And that's what made him decide to go with the Church of Satan. Mm-hmm. Is that he just sort of, he was asked to do a black mass at an event, and he came out and, with his sword and yelled out, "Open wide the gates of hell." And the room just fell silent. And people were just, people on the edge of their seats and just looking and watching, and they were just hypnotized by it. And that's when he realized, oh my God, this really is a powerful thing. This is, it's people responding to me as though I were the devil incarnate. And it's like, if I can have this influence over a room of some of the best and brightest of San Francisco's elite, then imagine, how easy it would be to reach the American public with this imagery. And, imagery is a part of, man's a very visual animal, and imagery is an important part of religious ceremony, it's an important part of politics, it's an important part of, rock and roll. You can't really underestimate the length to which you can use imagery or pageantry or something to, to make your point for you. Because I just saw pictures of LaVey in front of that black house, and I didn't need to read anything, because I knew he was doing this in the mid-60s when friends of the Hells Angels, who, were friends with my father, and they're friends with me, and they came back from San Francisco one week and said, because I was always into the occult, and this guy says, "Hey, what would you say if I told you there's a place in San Francisco called the Church of Satan?" And I said, "And it's a real church?" He said, "Yeah, they've even got a building. It's all painted black." And I said, "What do they believe in?" He said, "Well, rational self-interest and, men taking control of their own destinies." And I said, "Well, what's that have to do with Satan?" And he said, "Well, they also practice black magic and curse people and do have these great rituals with a lot of naked ladies." And I didn't even have to know anything more about it. Just for me to know that there are people someplace doing this, it just made me think that the possibilities of life just opened wide for me. I just thought it really is possible for a person to just live by their own law to do exactly what they want to do? Because if you think of the world of 1966, I mean, think of what was on TV, it was still very much like, you know, My Three Sons sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like people didn't even have really long hair yet in 1966. That was, you know.
And that line, actually that line that you just shared with us from the book about, oh yeah, it's about rational self-interest and men taking back their own lives. That's one that I highlighted on here. That's a really powerful line. And it's also, I think it really sums it up really well. You know, rational self-interest, personal responsibility, that's the elevator, you know, the elevator speech about what Satanism is. And if that appeals to you, if that makes sense to you, then that indicates that you're on that side of it. You know, you're on that side of the moral compass, as it were, as far as the question about individualism versus, you know, collectivism and altruism and all of these things.
Yeah, but still, even like the best ideas are not appropriate for everybody, because he sort of felt that those ideas about rational self-interest and all that stuff, placing yourself in the center of your own universe, it sort of led to the me generation, where it was mm-hmm. a bunch of people who weren't really cut out to be the center of their own universe. And he had the whole thing about people who say, oh, well, we think we're our own God. You know, mm-hmm. and he'd say, boy, if that person's their own God, they got a terrible religion, got a piss-poor mm-hmm. religion, you know. So it's like anything, any good idea, I think, you know, when it's taken over by the public can be, you know, degraded, diluted. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I think it inevitably will.
Yeah. No, it gets mass produced. Something's always lost and it always loses a little bit of the essence. But, you know, getting back to the, you know, the atheism question, and this is something, I mean, it's because it comes up, you know, satanic atheism is a thing. That's explicitly like what a lot of modern groups say. And they say, oh, it's so obvious. It's just so obvious that we're atheists, you know? And in my experience, it's not that obvious. You know, I can't see you going to, like, you know, Christopher Hitchens and saying, you know, oh yeah, you know, Satanism and atheism, that's the same thing. You know, I think he's going to tear that apart. And when you go back and you look in the Satanic Bible, you know, I mean, the only time he even mentions atheism in that book, well, the books before the current forewords that are in it, but the earlier versions of this book, the only time atheism comes up in it is when he criticizes. It criticizes Christian atheism, and in the chapter, you know, Hell, the Devil, and How to Sell Your Soul, he talks about how, you know, he addresses that question, you know, what is Satan? Is there a Satan? And he talks about dark forces in nature. And he says some Satanists don't even deal with this question, so it's not even necessary, right? And this is an important aspect, I think, of Satanism, is that belief is not that significant of a thing in it. That's not a prerequisite for being able to take control of your life and your destiny. But he talks about, you know, like dark forces of nature, and he talks about archetypes, an archetype as something that, you know, that other people can access. Not just, you know, this, not just my trip, but, you know, other people can, like, access this. And whatever that is, I'm not sure what it is, but to me, that's not atheism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what you were saying about belief is a prerequisite, I think, you know, it could go way further than that. I go way further than that. I think that the process of belief is innately flawed. That mm-hmm. the process of belief is like a fundamental form of tyranny. Mm-hmm. It tyrannizes the mind, because belief is about groupthink, whatever you believe. Whatever stripe uh-huh. of belief, it's like the realities of life as it is. Life as it is doesn't need explanations. You don't have to believe in, you know, anything. You can see with the evidence of your senses. And the only thing that gets in the way of the evidence of your senses is if you have beliefs that, you know, confuse them. So I think every belief is a false ideology. The road I'm on is abandon belief, abandon ideology, philosophies, forget about it. You don't need any of those things. And if you have them, they're just, they're going to tie you into groupthink.
No, that's very insightful, and I think that's accurate. Yeah, belief always implies groupthink. It implies, well, this is what I got to say to other people about it, and why is that necessary for you to cut your own way through the universe, as it were.
Yeah. So where were we going with that again?
I don't know. I can't remember. I thought you made a really good point about belief, the structure of belief, the whole nature of belief is unnecessary because belief is connected with groupthink of some kind.
Okay. I know what I was going to say is that I was going to say the deal is that 9 out of 10 people are hardwired to believe. They're hardwired to be part of the collective. And then 1% of people are hardwired to have independent thought and to think for themselves. And that ratio has remained the same throughout the history of the world. And those, it's like you don't look down at the collective because those are the people who sort of make things work. They're necessary. And you don't resent the people who are on top because they're actually making things happen. So you need these two parts of the puzzle to have the whole machine work. But to posit this idea that we're all equal, and then the contrary idea that we're all unique individuals, like neither of those things makes sense. 90% of people are hardwired one way because it's necessary, and 10% of people are hardwired another way because it's necessary. And you fall into one category or the other, and if you're in the collective, you obviously aren't aware of it.
Yeah. The thing is, what I think about the collective is, it's okay. Collectivism is okay if it's voluntary. And then I would say if it's voluntary, it's not really collectivism. It's more like, cooperation or collaboration, or people are just doing whatever they do and not worrying about it. The problem that we have, one of the problems that we have in the world is that collectivism is kind of forced, from on high, from, governmental systems and whatnot. And to me, a lot of Satanism is about trying to break out and liberate oneself from whatever forces, try and coerce you and try and push you down into conformity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't believe that anybody acts other than what their innate character is. So if your innate character is to be outside of all that, you will be. Even if you want to be inside that, you will be on the outside. And the people in the collective, it's the same thing. It's like they would be into some sort of group thing, whether it was forced upon them or it's voluntary. And it's, they've got all the options in the world. There's a million different ways they can dress. There's a million things they can be into. And they all choose to be into the same handful of things. They all seem to, wear their baseball cap the same way or whatever. So
sure.
I really don't think they have any choice. I don't think it's a matter of choice. I think most people are compelled to do something or to not do something because of the way they are.
So I was going to say, I was looking at this other piece that you mentioned in here about people who imagine Anton to be brooding, gloomy, and dour, have no idea the vast scope of his personality or his complexity. And LaVey was nothing if not complex, and the different aspects of his personality were like a puzzle formed of many interlocking pieces. And you also talk about here about the kind, his kindness, that he had a kind aspect to his personality. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, he was a kind of, you know, he was grew up in another generation, so he appreciated a lot of things that have sort of been lost in the modern world. So he appreciated, like, tenderness, and he appreciated, like, corny old love songs and things. And he felt like people are just sort of debased now. They sort of have forgotten really how to love, and they've forgotten how to hate appropriately. And mm-hmm. so he could like go to the extremes in both of those. And they, you know, he loved, I forget what it was called, but there was some opera about Roy de Ys, who he was like the king of this kingdom. He was involved in some war. All these people were dying, and he had a favorite tree, and the tree got hurt, and the tree was dying, and he was standing in front of the tree singing a song to it and weeping about how much he was going to miss that tree. And, you know, the tree meant more to this guy. He had this tenderness for the tree that he didn't have for humanity in general.
Right. And, like, he had for animals, too. So that's something that he always
God,
talked about.
Yeah.
Hey, like, his love for animals, his love for, you know, his Togar, the lion, and Dobermans. Did you ever get to witness that side of him firsthand?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, he had a couple of these desert cats. He had a black cat. He had a Maine coon cat. He had a boa constrictor, and the black cat was dying at one time, and it was getting so weak that it couldn't even leap up on his lap anymore. And he fed that cat. That cat was getting skinnier and skinnier. He fed that cat with an eyedropper until it eventually just, he woke up one morning and it was dead. And then he got a sort of metallic briefcase with locks on it, and he put that cat in that briefcase, and that cat remained in his kitchen probably until the day he died. He just loved that cat, and he loved Togar too. And I one of Togar's son was a lion named Trouble that was still at the San Francisco Zoo when I lived in San Francisco, so I'd always go and see him at feeding time, and I recorded a bunch of his roars and sampled them on one of my old albums, like I think it was Blood and Flame or something.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Sample Togar.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's
no, that was Togar's there. That was Togar's son, Trouble.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, still, it's the bloodline.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, they passed a law in the city of San Francisco that it was illegal to keep wild animals at your house just because of LeVay's lion, because that lion would roar at all times of night and keep people awake.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't do anything anymore. Hey, so what about you, Boyd? Do you have animals?
Oh, yes.
Cat person, dog person?
Cat person, absolutely. We've got two lovely cats. I'm sitting on the bed here, and we've got a black and white tuxedo cat named Mr. T, and we've got a big fat tabby cat named JJ. He's probably downstairs someplace or outside in the yard. And these guys are like our familiars. It's like Mr. T loves my wife Karen, and JJ's always in sleeping with me right up by my head. And they follow us around. Whatever room we're in, they follow us around and lay as close to us as they can.
That's awesome. So I was a cat person way back in the day, but then I acquired allergy to cats. And so so now I'm a dog person. I've got two Dobermans and a dachshund. And,
oh, great.
Yeah.
The full spectrum.
Yeah, it's a total spectrum. And, yeah, no, we're like family. We're all like family, and I love them so much. I don't have children either. These are my children. I'm married. I have a wife.
And the dogs are our babies. And, you know, that's just an important thing. I mean, people who have animals that have the connection with animals, it's like that says something about right there about who they are and what they're made of and what their moral fiber is, you know.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that it seems like animals become more and more popular the more this downward spiral of history gets. It's like it's sort of the last bastion of something pure is a relationship with an animal.
And
you just look on the internet and all the crazy cat videos and all the funny dog videos and stuff. You know,
yeah.
People are really fond of their animals.
Yeah. So some other things I wanted to ask you about. You've been to, because there's a lot. I mean, you've done a lot of shit. And it's just hard to, like, encompass it all into this. But so you went to René Le Chateau.
Yeah. A friend of mine is over there right now. He's taking some pictures for me.
Is that right? I became obsessed with this in 98 or so. I read the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and one of the things that came out of it is I started a musical project called Asmodeus X, which was, to some extent, based on some of the ideas and information out of that. And I've always wanted to go there, never had a chance. I saw you went there. You know, what was it like?
It was amazing. It was amazing because it's just... we went there with Fox Television. They were going to do bring back this old TV show In Search Of. It used to be Leonard Nimoy announced In Search Of. Yeah, so they're going to bring that back for a while. And the producer of this show liked my music. And so he found out I was into that, and so they flew me over there. And so I got to see the place in person, and it's very impressive. And a lot of, when you actually go there and see the stuff, you're aware that most of the people who write books about the mystery of René Le Chateau have never actually been there.
Is that right?
And because when you're there, you see all sorts of things jump out at you. And we went, the sacristy was, the door of the sacristy was nailed shut for some reason, and this woman allowed us and the camera crew to take the nails out and go inside this old thing with a dirt floor and spider webs, and, you know, there's a lot of amazing stuff there. And the tombstone of Béringer Saunier,
mm-hmm.
Somebody had taken a chisel to it and chiseled away so his cheekbone looked like a cheekbone of he made his face look like a skeleton, like a skull.
Oh, wow.
And it was very strange because it looked very intentional. And then I was on the other side of the cemetery, and I found, and it was a weird kind of yellowy colored rock stone. I don't know what kind of stone it was. I was on the other side of the cemetery, and I saw this weird triangular shaped yellow stone, and it was the very piece that had been knocked out of his tombstone. I held it up to his cheek, and it, like, you know, made a perfect face.
Whoa. Oh, that's amazing. So did you? So what happened? Did you keep it? Did you glue it back in? Or?
Oh no, I kept it. Okay. I was just looking at it a few days ago, as a matter of fact. Somebody was over here, and there was a plastic bag with all these old relics in it. And somebody said, "What's that weird piece of stone?" And I told them the René Le Chateau story. And they,
do you have a personal theory about the René Le Chateau story? Do you think like Holy Blood, Holy Grail? Is that inaccurate? Ideas or more to it than that?
Well, me and this idiot girl wrote a whole book about this one time, and I wrote 10 of the chapters, and she wrote 3 of the chapters, but we had a deal with Red Wheel Weiser, and because of her being an asshole, this thing was never printed. And if it had been printed, I'd probably be, you know, a wealthy man now. But if it had been printed, I would still be answering questions about Rennes Le Chateau, you know, 20 years later. So it's probably good that that book wasn't printed. It didn't become a bestseller. It allowed me to have some normal kind of life. But yeah,
so what was your angle on it?
Well, without being able to explain the whole story, I don't. I don't know if I could tell you what my final theory was, but I think there's something there, and I think I know what it is, and I think I know where it is, because there's. I had a map of. I noticed there were like certain recurring symbols there. Where there would be a symbol, and not far from it would be a very similar symbol. So to see two of these symbols in one place, I got a map of that the church at Rennes Le Chateau, and I made dots on all these pairs of symbols, and I drew these lines through several different pairs of symbols, and they all intersected at the very same place. So I think... You know, I think I wrote an open letter to the mayor of Rennes Le Chateau and said, you know, if you get ground penetrating radar, I'll show you, you know, where to examine. But never heard anything back.
Wow.
We were supposed to meet the mayor of Rennes Le Chateau while we were there, and have lunch with him. But at the last moment, something came up. But the Fox people were really worried because I said, oh, I've got a great joke to tell the mayor of Rennes Le Chateau. And they said, well, what is it? And I said, why do the French plant rows of trees along those long avenues out in the country? And they said, I don't know. Why? And I said, so the German troops can march in the shade. And they said, that's terrible. He said, please don't say that. Please don't. You'll embarrass us all.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. So the closest I came, I was in Paris in 2012. And I was at, and I wanted to go to Rennes Le Chateau, but I couldn't convince the people that I was with to go that direction, so I saw happening, and you know, I'm still kind of sore about it even to this day. But I remember looking online at it again, like I don't know, 2015, 2016, something like that. And it looked like it had totally built up a little tourism thing around it. Like there's little restaurants and stuff. Because when I looked at it before, it was like it wasn't really that much out there. So you really had to be kind of self-supportive, you know, if you're going to go out there. But it looks like they built up like a little, you know, like a little, I don't know, a little tourism industry, little bed and breakfast and restaurants and shops and stuff like that, which is probably, you know, not good for certain reasons, but also means that it might be easier to get there for some of us.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that when I was there. There's probably now, after the Dan Brown book and stuff, there's probably a shitload of stuff there. There's, there's probably Ramada nearby or something.
Right.
Because at the time, you could only stay in one other hotel that was near there. And it was a hotel that had a whole bizarre history around it. And aerial photos of this hotel look like the outline of the Madonna and Child. So this place was somehow tied into that, and there were all these weird sort of occult types there. There was a, you know, we had dinner with all these people who had this intimate knowledge of the whole story of Rennes Le Chateau, and one guy is a guy who said he'd he translated the world's oldest book. And it was a history of Atlantis called The History of Atlant, and that it was in some unknown language, and it was a typeface that looked very, very runic. It was all based on, like, a hexagon. All the letters could be formed within the confines of a hexagon. And and he had some weird chateau someplace, some castle, where once a year light would come through a certain window and light up an altar, and a fire would just form on this altar. And they had people from all over the world in there to try to figure out why this happened or how it happened. And none of the experts could figure out why.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was a very interesting place. But, yeah, there was a bookstore there called The Devil's Thumbprint, I think. And it was, like, a lot of books about the Cathars and the Templars and, you know, Renish
Wow.
Chateau.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I got that reminds me, I got a Czech version of the Satanic Bible.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was like, cool. It's in Czech. That's awesome. And it looks really nice. It's like hardcover.
Wow.
Very good. Yeah. Oh, and you've been to Russia too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm probably going back this February to do a show in Moscow and one in St. Petersburg.
Oh, that's awesome. So,
I had the best time when I was there before.
So this is something else that we have in common. I went to Russia and played a show in Moscow with the band Red Flag, you know, the kind of a new wave band from, you know, 1988. They had a Russian radio and If I Ever. Anyhow, they were like reformed. Like
Red Flag, were they... Were they the group that did some Manson songs and did, like, songs from Bewitched and stuff? Two brothers?
Yeah, they're two brothers, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Chris Reynolds. Chris Reynolds and his brother. I can't remember his brother's name. His brother died, and then he reformed the band. And I went on tour with them for a little while playing Trigger Pads. And we went and did a show in Russia, in Moscow. And this was like 2007. And it was amazing. I had so much fun. I was in the backstage, and it's like, I know a little bit of German, like just enough, you know, it was like if people are drinking, we can talk. And so there's people there who spoke German. There's people there who speak Russian. And then that band, Clan of Zymox, was there. And like everyone in that band is like from somewhere, you know, Estonia or Italy or something. So there's just all these languages going on. Everyone's, like, drinking, having a good time. I just had the fucking best time. And the Russian people, they're so musical, you know? It's like during the day, and you tell me if you had this experience, but during the day, everyone's, like, really somber and quiet and really, like, down to business and very unemotional. But as soon as, like, work is over, then there's drinks and they get really musical. I mean, people just hanging out in the hotel lobby would start like playing the guitar, you know, and we'd sing Yellow Submarine and stuff like that. It was just so much fun, you know.
Yeah, have you heard any of those stories about Vladimir Putin when he was a undercover agent in Paris? And he had long hair, and he would play the guitar and play these door songs, and everybody just, he was like some undercover agent for Russia, but everybody thought he was, you know, just this weird hippie folk singer guy.
Wow. Yeah, so what do you think of Russia? What's been your experience over there? How do you like it?
I just loved it. I loved the people. I loved the food. I loved the big Soviet monuments. I mean, they're just some fantastic things. And all this great modernist architecture. And, you know, I just, and, you know, I thought, this is weird going to Moscow because, you know, is anybody really going to know who I am? But as it turned out, there was this guy I met, this actor. He's like a Russian action adventure movie star, and he was the host of some counterculture show right when things started opening up, and he would always play my music on his show. So this whole generation that saw this show were familiar with like Music Martini's Misanthropy and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
I'd met Russian kids who said, oh, I got all of your albums on cassettes, you know, down in the market on our local square. And I found that difficult to believe that anybody would be bootlegging my albums. But one other thing, I got a huge, huge crowd, and I was protested by the Russian Orthodox Church because of my connection with LeMay. And
yeah.
I was told these people, if there are people protesting me, I'll go out and I'll talk to them, and they don't know who I am. They have no idea what I've done. But I was told, these people actually are fanatics. They will kill you. Don't go out and talk to these people. But they were actually, they had merch. They were selling T-shirts with these three skulls with knives in their teeth. And the T-shirt said, in Russian, of course, it said, be Orthodox or be dead.
Wow.
So somebody coming to the show bought me a T-shirt from my protesters.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. Another, I was just going to say, that actor guy, too, there's this restaurant that is only open to writers and actors, and it was Stalin's favorite restaurant. And I had one of the best meals of my entire life at that place. And it's a place
wow.
that's like covers an entire city block, and each room is gigantic, but each room is decorated in a specific period from Russian history. So you go through the whole thing, and you get to experience every architectural form of every aspect of Russian history, and it was just fantastic.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, my scariest moment?
My scariest moment was, so after we played the show and we had a day of nothing going on, Chris Reynolds and I, we went to try and see Lenin Tomb. We went to Red Square, and we wanted to see Lenin Tomb. And there's one of the girls who was one of the promoters who spoke Russian was with us and taking us through. We went down into the subway system, which is really fucking amazing. There's all these huge statues that have been there since, World War II era, that are just really quite extraordinary. And see, with the hotel we were staying at, you have to take a ticket from the hotel with you, and like when you leave your floor, and there's like this lady on the floor that you get the ticket from. So anyhow, it's like we forgot to grab the ticket because we were like from the we're like, what is this? What is this? This is stupid, and we just blew it off, right? And so we didn't have it. So anyhow, we're in Red Square, and one of the security guards there. Like, called us over, and he's talking to the girl, and they're speaking in Russian. We don't know what's going on. And we realize that they're talking more, and we realize that, Chris and I look at each other, and we realize there's some kind of problem here. And he wants to see our passports, and she explains, or they wanted to see our tickets from the hotel, which we didn't have. And so then he wanted to see our passports, and then he took our passports, and then they're continuing to talk. And that's when I started to get scared. I realized they got my passport now. They could do anything. This could go anywhere, and there's nothing I could do about it. And eventually what happened is one of the other promoters went by our old hotel, got our tickets, and came down there and showed them to the guy. And that was enough, and he let us go. And I'm like, wow. And we kept having to remind ourselves that it's not Soviet anymore, right? It's not Soviet anymore. but the culture feels like, it's different. It's different. But anyhow, that's my scary story from Russia. But other than that, you're right. It's like the food is just amazing. The people are amazing. And I loved it and look for any opportunity to try and get back there again sometime.
So did you ever actually get into Lenin's tomb?
No, we didn't get into it. It was closed, so we just looked at it from the outside and took a picture.
Yeah, because Crispin Glover said, Boyd, if you ever find yourself in Moscow, you've got to check out Lenin's tomb, because I don't mm-hmm. know what they did to him, but the way they embalmed him, it looks as though he was just alive earlier in the day. He looks mm-hmm. absolutely alive. He looks kind of like a waxworks figure, but he looks, perfectly preserved. And he said, it's unbelievable. But by the time I went there, I think they've got a thing now where the public can't see Lenin's tomb anymore. Or maybe it's open like one day a year or one day a month or something. So
And you know that,
that
embalming, that thing with Lenin and how they embalmed his body, that's all connected with the Soviet cosmism, which is basically the backbone of the Soviet space program, which was based on the philosophies of this guy named Fedorov, who was around at the time of like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and these guys. And he had a theory that eventually we will be able to, through science and technology, we will be able to recombine the dead molecules of everyone who has ever lived before and bring people back from the dead. And, you know, we
will...
Wow. Right, and we will resurrect our fathers, and then that generation will work on the next, resurrecting the next generation back, and eventually we're going to bring back everybody. And this ties in with, like, Russian... you know, the Orthodox perspective on the apocalypse and shit. And the Soviet space program, when that was born, they picked up on these ideas. Because if you're going to repopulate the world like that, you're going to run out of space. And we need to, that's why we need to colonize space. And that's why they needed to build rockets. And point, you know, Fedorov said, he read an article that in America where Americans were, like, pointing cannons at the sky to try and get it to rain. And he said, that's what we need to do in Russia. We have to point our cannons at the sky. And that was the motivation for the Soviet space program. And so that's why they had all this stuff with, you know, how they embalmed Lenin and stuff. Because, well, he might be coming back, you know?
Yeah, well, supposedly they sent Eva Peron's body to Russia to have her embalmed in the same way, and that her body looked absolutely lifelike. But I think her husband got out of power before he was going to build a giant tower where people would, like, climb all these stairs and then see her body lying in a glass coffin.
Well,
so I don't know that ever happened to him, but I wish he'd finish that before he kicked the bucket or whatever happened.
Yeah. So let's change gears because I want to talk to you about Throbbing Gristle. I know you went and worked with Throbbing Gristle like back in the day, and I want to hear about that. Do you have any stories?
Oh, yeah. Do I have stories? Yeah, I was actually corresponding with them when they were an art group, before they started doing their band, and they had just started doing TG. But I wrote letters to Jen and Cozy and stuff, and all they were part of this male art movement, and Richard Kirk from Cabaret Voltaire was involved in that. So I was in touch with him before, before anybody knew who Cabaret Voltaire was, just because we had a mutual interest in Dadaism. So, so I wrote Jen and Cozy, and I there were like some men's magazines over here that had pictures of them wearing the Gary Gilmore shirt they did. And so I sent them copies of these magazines. They would write me when the first time I was staying in San Francisco. And then first time I went to London on May 78, I went over to their studio at 10 Martello Street, and just when I got there, Cozy was coming up the steps, and she had this eye makeup like Twiggy or something, and she's wearing a super short dress, and she just looked fabulous and mod and stuff, and so she invited me back to their place. What's the name of that street? Anyway, it's a street a lot of people lived on at one time or another. It became like a little mecca for people. But so then eventually I met Jen, and then I met Sleazy and Chris. And, every time I'd go to London, I'd sort of see them and hang out with them. So this was like, I got there. When I met them, it's like their first single, United, had just come out. And the first annual report had just come out, and it had, there were 750 copies or something, and they had sold out. So whenever they saw a copy in a store, they would buy it and then, you know, allow their friends to reimburse them for it. So there's kind of like a big black market for that. And John Savage had written a big article about Throbbing Gristle. And everybody read it, and they were just thrilled about everything that TG said, and they couldn't wait to hear the record, but you couldn't get it. And you know, I was at a party where these people actually had the record, and they were playing First Annual Report. And people were talking, had been talking earlier about how much they liked Throbbing Gristle. And then at a certain point they said, "What the hell is this that we're listening to in here?" And I said, "That's Throbbing Gristle." They said, "This is Throbbing Gristle? You're kidding." And at that time, people, you know, I was interested, I was attracted to Jen because we had a mutual interest in, like, true crime figures and, you know, Manson and Ian Brady and stuff like that. So it's like, at that time, literally nobody in the entire world found that stuff interesting. And people thought that if you were interested in that, that you were probably a murderer. So I remember I went, I spent the night over at his house one night, and people were saying, "You're actually going to spend the night at Genesis P. Orange's house?" I said, "Yeah, why not?" And they said, "This guy's into Charlie Manson and stuff. What, you know, he might kill you." I said, "You know, actually, he served me tea and biscuits and, you know, zipped up my sleeping bag for me, you know."
Yeah.
And then I played with them at, I was in Germany and I was in Berlin playing the show at the Excess Club, and I knew they were coming into town. I told them I'd be there, and they all showed up for my concert in Berlin. And after the show, Jen says, "Well, you know, you should stay in Berlin and you could open up for us. You know, it would be like a united front, you know, a non and TG against the world." So I said, okay. And I think, as far as I know, that's the only time Throbbing Gristle ever had an opening band.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. So I discovered Throbbing Gristle, like, yeah, it had to be like 1982 or something like that, at a used record store in Lincoln, Nebraska. And you know, everyone I knew was into, you know, what do you call it? Like kind of the indie post-punk thing. You know, everyone was into, you know, New Order and, you know, Cocteau Twins and 4AD, you know, all the stuff on 4AD, all that kind of stuff. And I found the album Heathen Earth and I thought, this looks like really cool. And it reminded me because it seemed satanic, right? Because I'd also read the Satanic Bible and I was into that kind of stuff. And so I got it because of that. And that's still today. That's probably my favorite TG album. Next to that being Second Annual Report, and you know, and I the shit kept showing up in the used section there. So whoever was getting
records,
they'd buy them. You know, they're buying from the regular record store because they thought it was cool. But then they'd listen to it and they'd be like, "What is this?" And they'd get rid of it. So I picked them all up. So I got all this old TG vinyl still. And I mean, to me, that's industrial music, right? They had industrial records. That's the first time I encountered that term, you know, industrial applied to music. And you know, to me, that's where it all started. And then shortly after that, because I was into Throbbing Gristle, eventually I met someone else who's into that and PTV. And then the research guides come up, and that's where I first started hearing about, you know, the stuff that you were doing at the time.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's funny because that whole industrial movement, all the people in that industrial culture handbook are so different from one to the other, but they're all lumped into this category just because they were all doing stuff that didn't sound like what most other people were doing. And since Throbbing Gristle had come up with the catchphrase industrial music, critics love that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
So yeah, I purposely didn't make up a moniker for what I did. I thought, I don't want to say that it's this kind of music or that kind of music. And having not done that, I got lumped in with industrial music, but, which is
right.
Fine with me, you know.
So and Non, was Non, is that your kind of like your first musical project?
No, the first musical stuff I did was stuff like my first album, The Black Album. It was kind of this atmospheric ambient music. But then I started, after I got into that, I started doing noise music at the same time. So I was giving performances of noise music in various art galleries up and down California. And then I met Zev at one of them, a place in San Francisco called La Manel.
Oh, yeah.
And Zev was just starting out playing at the Mabuhay Gardens, which was a big punk rock place in San Francisco. And he said, you know, you ought to get into the scene of playing this punk circuit because nobody's figured out what punk is yet. So somebody like me can sneak in, you know, like sneaking into the circus or something, and people don't know that it's not, you know, part of the punk scene. So I started doing that, and it's like, you know, we do performances in art galleries, and you know, we wouldn't be paid a cent, but we would show up in these little rock and roll clubs, and it was, you know, it was like we were taking our music right to the street. It was like we were taking it to people who weren't just art people sort of scratching their chin and figuring out what the subtext was of what you were doing. They're just people who experienced it.
And this was in San Francisco?
Yeah, well, San Francisco, and then there were clubs like that in San Diego, clubs like that in L.A., and then me and Zev went to play Boston. We played at New York and, you know, all over the place.
So I'm just trying to connect it all with other things. So what kind of punk bands were you about that you, like, got to do shows with at the time?
I regularly did shows with these bands, Monitor, The Human Hands, and The Bee People. But I played on all sorts of bills. I opened for Wall of Voodoo. A band that was around that was really great at the time was called The Screamers. And they were it was an all-electronic punk band. And it was just really visceral, ear-piercing stuff. And they were so amazing. Everybody expected them to be the next big thing. And everybody wanted to sign them. But they were holding out to do a video disc. And they never got the opportunity to do that. So, unfortunately, you know, they went nowhere.
Yeah. Wow. And Walla Voodoo, that's pretty intense. That's one of those bands that, they were just so, everyone likes Mexican Radio, but the album that they put out, they had all these other songs on it, like Lost Weekend and stuff like that. It's like really a underrated band. It's like, whatever happened to them, you know?
Yeah, I'm surprised you aren't hearing about a reunion tour with them.
Right.
Anybody else is doing it.
Right, because their music is out there. I mean, for whatever reason, it's like, I mean, that you know, Mexican Radio has just been, I mean, I think that charted or something. It's been like, you know, just replicated like a meme forever. So it seems like they could easily get back together. You know, or maybe, you know, if there's only one guy left who's alive, he could, you know, get it back together and have a good time with it.
Yeah, who was the lead singer? Was his name Stan?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Oh, because I know that the night I opened for them, I had to, like, I was going out of the country the next day or something, so I had to, leave before the whole evening was over, and the lead singer for the Wall of Voodoo kept calling me long distance in San Diego saying, hey, I've still got this $75 for you. When are you going to be here again?
So that's why you...
Stan Ridgway.
He still owes you
Stan Ridgway. Oh, no, I think he eventually gave it to somebody I knew or something. I eventually ended up getting that, Stan Ridgway was the guy's name, yeah, the singer.
That sounds right. Oh, my God, that's awesome. Okay, so I got to ask a little bit about one of my favorite Boyd Rice albums from back in the day was Hatesville. And,
okay.
And around that time, I was hatched as Fritz Partridge, and you know, Gittle was kind of my, kind of like, you know, led me through that process at the time, and the Partridge Family Temple was totally a thing in Kenosha at one point. Can you talk a little
about
the Partridge Family Temple?
Okay, well, when the Partridge Family was on, I mean, I was probably 16 or 17. I was probably too old to be watching it, but I never missed it. I really liked it, and I liked their music. So when I moved to Denver, we were waiting to go into this record store called Wax Tracks, waiting to cross the street, and this car drove by, and it was completely covered in bubble gum and had little toys glued on it and stuff. And I said, I'd like to know the story behind that. I'd like to meet the people who are driving in that car. And the girl with me said, oh, yeah, those are the guys from the Partridge Family Temple. And I said, what's that? And she said, they've got this whole religion based around the Partridge Family, where, you know, there's this mother goddess, and Lori's the Scarlet Whore of Babylon, and, you know, Keith is the god of war, and Danny's the trickster god. And I said, I got to fucking meet these people. So I was writing for this magazine, this free giveaway magazine at the time, called Colorado Music Magazine. It's one of those, like, newspapers. It's free in every record store. So I pitched to them the idea of, like, I want to go up and interview these Partridge Family Temple people. And they said, oh, yeah, that would be fun. So it ended up, they were on the cover of this magazine. It's like, it was Dan and Sean Partridge inside a hollowed out TV set, you know. And mm-hmm. So that was their first major publicity. Besides, they got some publicity because they were, got thrown out of a David Cassidy concert for handing out Partridge Family Temple stickers. And the police thought they were handing out LSD with pictures of the Partridge Family on it. And that's what Danny Bonaducci were told. He said, what's all this ruckus? And they said, we had these members of a weird cult, and they're passing out the LSD with your pictures on it. And he said, wow, that's great. So he thought it was cool. It scared the hell out of David Cassidy.
Danny's always the coolest.
Yeah.
So then...
I just met them, and then, you know, I got a letter from Dan after I interviewed them in Boulder in front of the Mork and Mindy house. And a week later, I got a letter arrived for me. It was addressed to Boyd Partridge, and it was from Dan. So it's like I sort of became part of, you know, it's like I was hanging out with those guys. And they had a whole network of people here, a whole network of these people who are like wearing this groovy kind of 70s clothing and big floppy hats that look like the American flag and stuff. It was fun. We had a lot of fun when those people all lived here in Denver still.
Yeah.
Now they've scattered across the globe to spread the word.
So what about Gittle? Do you ever talk to her anymore?
No. You know, nobody talks to her anymore. She's just... she's a pathological liar, you know.
Okay.
It's a shame, but, you know, it's like her father thought I was crazy when I said, I'm not having anything more to do with your daughter. And he's like, boy, what the hell is your problem? And then he eventually realized, like, yeah, she's a little crazy. She's a little bit of a pathological liar. And people who, when I say, listen, you're going on the internet telling lies about me, don't put words in my mouth. Don't say I've said things that I haven't said. She said, I didn't do that. I said, I've seen it. So, you know, she did that one too many times, and it's just like, no. And most of the people who knew her just said, you know, it's like Matt Skiba is a friend of mine. You know, he's in Blink 182 and the Alkaline Trio, and he knew her, and he said, you know, I really like Gittle, but she's too much negative energy. You know, I can't be around her because I'm a very positive guy, you know. I don't want to be around somebody who has enemies and, you know, wants to destroy people and wants to ruin their lives.
Yeah. So,
but the other Partridges are great, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I remember the first time I remember meeting Gittle was when I was touring with Morphine Angel, and we had like a night off, and we were near Pittsburgh, and the Hellfire Club was playing in Pittsburgh with Spawn Ranch, and we were in touch with Thomas. Said, "Hey, well, you're in the neighborhood. Come hang out with us." And so we went and hung out with them during their show, and this is where Gittle was like. had hooked up with them on the road, and she was like merchandising for them, and she's going around like drawing X's on everyone's foreheads that night. like the Matt, did you know the Spawn Ranch guys, Matt Green?
I knew one of those guys. I knew the guy whose brother was on American Idol.
Yeah, American Idol. That's actually the last time I saw Gittle was when American Idol was on. We were watching it. And Ethan is the guy, and then it's his brother, Constantine or something like
Constantine,
that.
Constantine, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and like he's doing it. It's like that first season, I think, of American Idol when everyone's watching it. And I'm watching it with my wife, and it's like the camera pans out over the crowd. It's like, oh, my God, that's that Gittle chick. But she was the kind of girl that she was never anyone's girlfriend, and she always had a problem with everyone else's girlfriend. So it was just all, you know what I mean? But,
yeah, I know. Problems. Always need somebody to hate, you know?
Yeah, a lot of negative energy. But anyhow, there was always that Partridge Family Temple movement, that whole idea, that meme, that feel. It was all about positivity, you know? And for me, I mean, I watched, you know, that television show when I was probably like, you know, 6, 7 years old when it was like playing on TV. I was related to Danny. Danny was the guy in the group that was like closest to my age. And so, I don't know, you know, I took a low-key, you know, mischievous imprint, and I ended up playing a bass, too, like first band. But, I always, like, took a lot of inspiration out of that Partridge Family Temple and thought that was a real fun thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, talking to Sean Partridge on the phone is like... is taking a roller coaster ride on LSD or something. I mean, you can't talk to this guy without just being transported into his universe, and it's a completely alternate universe where everything is fun and everything, you know, fast food restaurants have a mystical significance, and, you know, it's if you treat everything that way, everything has that power. Everything's imbued with that power. You know,
yeah.
It's really, it really is a religion based on fun.
Yeah. And that's very satanic, too, to bring it all back to Satanism and the sort of magic that Anton LaVey wove has this idea that your inner wish, your inner, you know, vision about how the world should be, you have the power to, through the power of your mind, to create a world like that, to make a world like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I have these ideas about the alchemy of aesthetics, about how you can apply aesthetics to your life. And LaVey had these ideas about people creating total environments. And very few people I know actually bother to do this, but you can. Like, people come, movers come in, like a couple Mexican guys, like carrying in a couch to our house, and one of them will like look around and go, "Who designed your house, man? Stanley Kubrick?" It's like everybody relates to my house. Everybody says, "This looks like something out of Clockwork Orange," you know. So, and it's like I'm living in this beautiful, ultra modern movie set with all this amazing stuff from 1969, 1970. So you can remake your world. You know, it's like this is a place that, if I could never leave this house, I would never leave it, because nothing outside is as interesting as this. And when we were talking about people and their options earlier, that's something I was thinking of commenting on. It's like, I know people who are rich. I know people who are millionaires, and you go to their houses, and they've done nothing particularly special with it. They've, you know, just looks like they randomly bought one piece of something here, one piece of something from someplace else, and it's just like you think, your house is like your life. You could turn it into whatever you want it to be. It's like the limits are only that of your imagination, you know, and people don't do it. So that's it's so good for me. I'm living the ideal life, and everybody else is creating problems where they don't exist and enjoying being miserable.
Yeah. Now, most people are miserable and unhappy because that's where they want to be. And so you create a world that you create your reality. So that's something that, you know, is just the way it is. So Boyd, you got a new album coming out too. Aren't you working on some new music?
Yeah, I finished this album about maybe 3 years ago, and it's just been held up. But I just recently heard from the guy at Mute Records, and he says now the release date, I heard a little while ago it was going to be September, so I was looking forward to it coming out soon, but now they say it's going to be October. So it's going to be, on vinyl, it's going to be a 2-record set and a gatefold album. And each side of the record is just like a 20-minute drone. It's really loud and harsh. And and some people who've heard it think it's, you know, the best thing I've ever done. And and I sort of think that, too. Because it's like sort of the truest thing to my initial intention of just doing something absolutely as minimal as you can be. And I had this idea when I was a teenager that if you had one single tone and you played it so loud that it blocked out all other sounds, you'd be creating this kind of artificial silence, because I felt that, like, the world is too full of distractions. That, you know, it's very difficult anymore to have just time alone with your mind for undirected thought, because unless you're on the toilet or in the bathtub, you know, there's always some sort of sound going on.
Yeah.
Intruding.
Excellent. Well, that's awesome. Well, I look forward to release of that. And man, this has just been an incredible conversation. There's so much we talked about that just resonates so strongly. Do you have any final words for all of our listeners out there that might help them through the dark times that lie before us?
Go on Amazon.com and buy my new book, The Last Testament of Anton Zandor LaVey. It's a very fun read, and I think it paints a good portrait of the old man that I knew way back when.
Excellent. And I reiterate that, yes, everyone pick up this book. It's awesome. I've greatly enjoyed it. There's so much great material in here, so many great memories that you're sharing, and excellent photographs. So it's a wonderful offering. I highly recommend it. And
and when it debuted on Amazon as number one bestseller in the category of religious studies. And I think they must have gotten some feedback about that, because it vanished from the religious studies category and reappeared as the number one bestseller on Satanism and demonology in that category.
Well, that means you're definitely turning over, kicking over some tabernacles there somewhere. So that's a good thing. So I'm glad to hear that. So, all right. Well, Boyd, thank you so much for spending this time with us this evening.
It's been excellent. It's been excellent. And I wish I could say, I have so many great Genesis Peorage stories that I wish I could have thought of something really amusing for you. Because there's all these, stuff like, there was a rumor at one time, somebody stole Charlie Chaplin's cadaver, and the rumor was going around that it was me and Genesis P. Orridge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's bizarre.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's crazy. But you hadn't.
No.
Okay.
But that was happening. That happened right before I went and played with him at the SO 36 in Berlin. So discussed it in the coffee bar there.
So what we should do is have you come back on the show, like after the album comes out. Let's have you come back on the show, and we'll make a point we'll make it a music and Genesis Peorage anecdotes show. I got a couple of I talked to him via email. I was in a band. We did a cover of Good Vibrations, and had some exchanges with him about that. And then I saw them go play in Houston, and had an exchange with him there. So we could totally do like an anecdote thing. And I'm sure you've got some incredible stories from back in the day. I would love to hear all those, man. That would just be awesome.
Okay, well, make a few notes for the next time and set them aside.
Definitely. Excellent. Cool.